It is Monday, November 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump promises a major statement following his trip to Asia. A deadly earthquake strikes the Iran-Iraq border, and a 50-year partnership preserves films for hundreds of years. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump's five-nation, 12-day trip to Asia is nearing an end. On Monday, Trump held meetings with leaders from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Manila, including Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. I spoke with reporter Ralph Jennings in the Philippine capital and asked about the meeting of the two leaders of the U.S. and the Philippines.
The only unusual thing that I heard is that, and this is something that the president's office in Manila confirmed, is that Trump asked Duterte to sing because he had been led to believe somewhere that he was a good singer, and Duterte did indeed sing. So getting at your other question, they got along pretty well because they had that personal connection. Trump's entire trip to Asia has been marked and kind of speckled by these personal moments where he just tries to get to know the people who he meets as people instead of the conduits to the various issues that he wants to talk about.
Because President Duterte is well known for making, I think you could say, insulting comments about leaders. Former President Barack Obama, he made a disparaging comment about him last year. And he's also been open about some of the killings he has been involved in.
Yeah, that came up. The drug killings came up this way. Duterte brought it up himself. He kind of shone a lantern on the issue, and he talked about why the drug problem had gotten out of hand and described it in quite some detail, apparently. And Trump didn't make any comment about it. He listened, he nodded his head, and he asked a couple of questions, one of which was whether the drug problem here in the Philippines is as bad as it is in Central America. And Trump said that in some cases, yes. So it was basically a listen and learn experience, meaning that Trump did not do what Obama had done, which is to criticize the supposed extrajudicial killings as a method of controlling the problem.
What was the reception like regarding President Trump's arrival in Manila in the Philippines?
He arrived literally in the dark. It was nighttime. I think it was nighttime or almost dark. It's a little bit before 6 p.m. And unlike the other leaders who came, or most of the other leaders, he did not want it broadcast on the closed-circuit TV that we have in the ASEAN press room. So he came rather low-key, and just as well perhaps because a couple of hours earlier, about 3,000 people, a little bit more, were marching toward the U.S. Embassy in Manila to ask that Trump not be allowed to stay here because they think that U.S. presence, especially military aid, actually incites more wars than it's able to stamp out.
Well, on Monday, a scheduled meeting between President Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull expanded to include Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. What is known to have come out of the meeting of three as opposed to two?
The three of them agreed emphatically that they want some kind of containment of North Korea. And it's not clear exactly what they said, whether they came up with specific ideas. I went to the news conference given by Abe's spokesperson just a couple of hours ago, and he was saying that Abe is quite committed to what Trump is committed to doing, which is whatever it takes to throttle North Korea. And that seems to be, from the news reports I saw, the upshot of their meeting.
Well, meanwhile, there are reports that President Trump is going to make a major statement when he returns to Washington, when he returns to the White House later this week. And apparently, that statement will focus on North Korea. Is there anything known about the substance of that?
I believe the statement will cover North Korea as well as trade. I would be safer in talking about trade because he has said throughout his visit to Asia, starting from November 3rd or 4th, that he is interested in free trade with Asian countries as long as it's fair. In other words, he doesn't like trade deficits with the U.S. where the U.S. is on the losing side, and he doesn't like countries that are intransparent or don't follow trade rules. So I'm guessing that his announcement will cover trade deals with Asia on the conditions that he's kind of described on his trip. Now, what he would say about North Korea, I really can't guess. I've been thinking as we talk here what I would guess he would say. I don't think he's going to declare war. That's not something that Asia wants to see at all. And Asians have lived with North Korea for decades, literally, and they understand that Kim Jong-il is going to do what he does, or his son now, and they do what they do, and they just live with it. War never happens.
Ralph Jennings reporting from Manila. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, lots to talk about from President Trump's Asia trip. A lot of talk about different handshakes. There was, of course, a handshake with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and then a statement from President Trump afterwards that Putin believes that Russia didn't interfere in the U.S. election, but Trump saying that he does trust the U.S. security agencies. So that was getting dissected by quite a lot of people over the weekend. There was also the handshake at the ASEAN meeting that was kind of awkward, is one word that I've seen used to describe it on social media, where the leaders all cross arms and link hands, and President Trump kind of had to hunch over because he's rather tall, and some of these Asian leaders are less so. So a lot of attention on that photo. And then, of course, with the meeting with President Duterte, hotly anticipated meeting, Duterte has often been compared to Trump. And so that meeting had a lot of watchers on social media and a lot of reaction to a comment that Duterte made calling the media spies at one point, saying that he and Trump had to meet out of the way of the spies that were there, and Trump laughing at that. That got a lot of attention on social media as well. On Twitter, however, it was one tweet from President Trump in particular that a lot of people, not just talking about, but worried about, where he wrote, "Why would Kim Jong-un," referring to the North Korean leader, "insult me by calling me old when I would never call him short and fat? Oh, well, I try so hard to be his friend, and maybe someday that will happen." Many people saying that this is devolved to kind of childish name calling. But there's a kind of kernel of concern in this that people are worried, is this going to spark war or kind of conflict or maybe make the relationship worse? We'll have to see what happens.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that we're following. Turkish and Russian presidents meet in Sochi to resolve their differences over Syria. The FBI says hate crimes have increased by 4.6% in 2016. An Alabama Republican rebuffs growing calls to end his U.S. Senate candidacy. And singer Bob Geldof returns an award he shared with Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Did you ever have one of those days when you were feeling great, in a wonderful mood, and then you run into a couple of friends who were in a pretty bad mood? You quickly realize that that great feeling and good mood is suddenly gone. Now, a new study headed by researchers at the UK's University of Warwick suggests that there might be a connection between the effect of your friend's mood, whether good or bad, has on your own and on your network of friends. But the study also found that the effect of bad mood friends wasn't enough to push you or your friends into depression. Findings in the study were made after researchers analyzed data from a year-long study of U.S. adolescents. The researchers say they found evidence that suggests the spreading of a mood from person to person is done via a process known as social contagion. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, more comment on the U.S. intelligence and Russia. An earthquake that struck Sunday along the Iraq-Iran border has killed more than 400 people and injured at least 2,500 others. Iranian state media reported the majority of the victims were located in the town of Sarpoli Zahab in Kermanshah province. The U.S. Geological Survey said the earthquake was magnitude 7.3 with a center near the town of Halajba in Iraq's Kurdistan region. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said he directed health and aid agencies to do whatever they can to provide assistance. I spoke with Yassin Abbas, president of the Iraqi Red Crescent Society. Speaking from Baghdad, he tells me about efforts to help those affected.
The risk rescuing those who were under the wreckage. Second, first aid on the spot. And the third, transportation by ambulance transportation to the hospital. Hospital care, of course, took place there for wounded and some operations for fixing the fractures, broken arms, legs, and treating the wounds. And some of the patients are still in the hospital, some being discharged after receiving the initial treatment in the hospital. So these were the main services on the spot and initially. Then we also provided shelters for those who have been displaced from the damaged houses and providing food with psychosocial support.
Is your organization, do you just stay strictly on the Iraq side of the border? Are you able to go into Iran at all?
Yeah, we can, of course, if they call for us. But I think the Iranian Red Crescent, they already managed to provide support to their people. And we are here, you know, we are not only dealing with the recent earthquake victims, but we have more than 3 million people being displaced during the 4 years of conflict with ISIS. So we have also a big task here in Iraq, besides what we have now for the earthquake victims.
I understand that the earthquake has cut power and telephone service to a number of towns, which has made the rescue effort more difficult.
Yeah, it was for a while, only for a while, actually, not more than 10 to 15 minutes, even in Baghdad, the phone calls or the phone connection cut. But it's now very normal, and we are communicating with our staff in the affected areas.
All right. Is there anything else you would like to say or you'd like me to ask you?
I'd like just to add that we have received a very good support from Turkish Red Crescent, and this morning, there was an airplane loaded with aids landed in Sulaymaniyah Airport, and we have been also informed that a big convoy will be crossing the border from Turkey to Iraq, loaded with a big amount of aids to Iraqi Red Crescent to manage to support its relief operation in the area.
Yassin Abbas, president of the Iraqi Red Crescent Society. President Donald Trump has been criticized by former members of the U.S. intelligence community for defending his Russian counterpart's insistence Russia did not meddle in last year's U.S. election, while insisting he holds to the U.S. assessment Moscow did interfere, a charge that's being investigated by a special counsel. Mr. Trump earlier referred to these former officials as political hacks. But the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said Sunday the fact the president of the United States would take Mr. Putin, that is Russian President Vladimir Putin, at his word unconscionable, astounding, and a peril to the U.S. The former head of Central Intelligence, John Brennan, called Mr. Trump's accusation reprehensible. Jonathan Adelman, an international affairs professor at the University of Denver, was asked by International Edition's Victor Beatty whether Russia can play a constructive role to resolve some of the world's trouble spots despite allegations of election tampering.
Certainly Russia could help. I mean, there's no doubt. The Russians made all the difference in Syria. If you remember back 6 years ago when all this started, people, including myself, thought they're not going to last. Bashar Assad is finished. And so there's no question that the Russians are important, although I would say not as much for North Korea. But I think the broader point is that from what we know, and that's only what's kind of publicly known right now, the agencies are much more dubious of what the Russians are trying to do. And not simply perhaps to Donald Trump, but also perhaps to Hillary Clinton. So I think there's a gap there between what we seem to think, what most of the intelligence of which we have 17 agencies think, and what the president thinks.
Former CIA Director John Brennan and former National Intelligence Director James Clapper both said the president was mishandling Moscow ties, even as the special counsel investigates possible collusion between Mr. Trump's campaign and Russia. Mr. Brennan, quote, "I think Mr. Trump is, for whatever reason, either intimidated by Mr. Putin, afraid of what he could do or what might come out as a result of these investigations. It's either naivete, ignorance, or fear in terms of what Mr. Trump is doing vis-a-vis the Russians. Mr. Clapper said, I do think both the Chinese and Russians think they can play him, referring to Mr. Trump.
I'd have to agree with most of that. I'm actually puzzled why the president, at a time when the Mueller investigation is still ongoing, and he's insisting that they did nothing at all, then he would come out and endorse basically the Putin position. I'm not saying that Vladimir Putin doesn't want to make a deal. In fact, I just wrote an op-ed that dealt with the extent to which he might be willing to make a deal in some of those areas. But to deal with the Russians, you have to deal firmly. You have to remember they were a superpower, and now they've lost, but they have 7,000 nuclear weapons. And what's really amazing, in a bad sense, is that the world is going much more in the authoritarian direction that Russia is going, kind of non-communist, authoritarian, strong religiosity, and so forth. And so given all of that, the Russians feel that they are on a winning streak. I mean, whether it's Crimea, or it's West Ukraine, or it's Abkhazia and southern Ossetia and now Syria, and to seem to just allow what they say to go unchallenged, that I find a little odd. I'm not certain what his motivation is in that. It's bad politics. If you're a Republican, that is bad politics.
Jonathan Adelman, International Affairs Professor at the University of Denver. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. In a star-studded night in Washington, the American Film Institute and the Library of Congress celebrated 50 years of partnership in film preservation. VOA's Penelope Pulu attended the event and spoke with representatives from the Library of Congress and the AFI.
Actor Morgan Freeman, American Film Institute founder George Stevens, and House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi were among the celebrities honoring half a century of partnership between the AFI and the Library of Congress.
I think the AFI is important to all of us because its number one goal is the preservation of American film.
No. He's looking at you, kid.
When the AFI began its preservation process in 1967, less than one-tenth of the American films made in the early 20th century had survived, says George Stevens.
And we, working with the Library of Congress, did a great search and rescue operation and recovered films, and the library has reproduced them on safety film stock. So now there are 37,000 motion pictures in the AFI collection here at the Library of Congress.
This is an ongoing process, says the Librarian of Congress, Carla Hayden.
Early films and some that are rare and really are in terrible physical shape are preserved for posterity. And so our Packard campus in Culpeper, Virginia, has special vaults to preserve films that are in danger of nitrate and exploding.
2 hours away from Washington, D.C., at the library's large film preservation facility, nitrate film vault manager George Willeman explains the challenges involved in saving older nitrate films from destruction.
The nitric acid that makes up the film begins to break down the film after so many years, especially if there's something wrong with it, if it wasn't processed right, or it was badly produced, or it was in bad storage conditions, like very humid or very hot. and the film will begin to liquefy.
Technicians transfer damaged nitrate film onto a sturdier polyester-type film material, which, if stored properly, can last for hundreds of years. And then there's the digital conversion, which, as Morgan Freeman says, reaches wider audiences.
Not only are they archiving these movies, they are also circulating through television channels, television stations. And movies are movies. The only big difference between when you were growing up and I was growing up and now is that you don't have to go into the movie theaters to see it.
But George Willimon says preserving film in digital form may not be effective.
How do you save digital material? You can store it magnetically or optically or on a card or something like that, but none of those are permanent. And something can disrupt them and your stuff's gone.
Where's Kansas?
Whether stored in their original form or restored, the power of film is timeless, says filmmaker Leslie Linka Glatter.
Film is a huge part of our history, and if we don't cherish it, and preserve it, it will not be with us. So we have to do that, and the fact that AFI has been so dedicated to that is essential and extraordinary.
I'm happy again.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
I'm singing and dancing in the rain.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Each November, the world marks the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists. Around the world, journalists often work at great personal risk to shine a light on abuses and corruption, expose threats posed by transnational criminal organizations, and counter disinformation and propaganda. These efforts play an indispensable role in the healthy functioning of our own democracy and also underpin democratic values around the world, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Due to their profession, journalists are often under threat from those who wish to silence them. In too many parts of the world, crimes against journalists go unpunished. In Syria, both local and foreign journalists have regularly been attacked and killed while reporting on the conflict. In Venezuela, the government arbitrarily closes media outlets as punishment for reporting facts or maintaining an editorial line critical of the regime. Security forces and armed colectivos that harassed and physically attacked journalists during protests earlier this year remain unpunished. In Iraq, media workers report accounts of intimidation, death threats, and harassment. In Sudan, the government arrests, harasses, and intimidates journalists with impunity. In Uganda, security forces continue to intimidate journalists and media houses, and government officials have shut down radio stations for broadcasting voices in opposition to the government. In Nigeria and South Sudan, there is no evidence of accountability for police and their officials who have abused journalists. For the third year in a row, Somalia holds the world's worst record for unsolved murders of journalists. In Russia, the lack of progress toward any accountability for the killing of high-profile journalists persists. In Turkey, perpetrators of attacks against journalists or independent media institutions often receive minimal penalties. This impunity has been exacerbated by the use of the judicial system to target independent media. In Azerbaijan, 9 out of 10 physical attacks against journalists go unsolved. Together with others in the international community, the United States will continue working to eliminate impunity for crimes against journalists. The United States renews its dedication to promoting a free, professional, and independent press abroad, and to advocating for accountability for those who would undermine a free press with threats, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.